Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. It is Monday, June 15th, as I record this. And boy, is this year just smoking by. I'll tell you what, it's been crazy busy. I'm still waiting on word from ETAR, whether that's going to happen for sure or not. That's the Eastern Traditional Archery Rendezvous, for those of you who aren't familiar with that acronym. It's back in Western Pennsylvania, huge shoot, and I'm actually surprised that they haven't called it. I think they're trying to be optimistic, but doesn't seem like any large gatherings are going on anywhere. So to think that this is going to happen seems like I said, optimistic, but you know, maybe they'll pull a rabbit out of the hat, and they're kind of waiting on, I think, local jurisdictions to see what they're going to do ultimately on making a decision. So I'm hoping it does happen, because it is a blast, you know, for a shoot, and every other event that I was supposed to go to so far this year has been canceled. We're going to be doing a shoot up in Nebraska. That Jake Downs is putting together in towards the end of July, the weekend before ETAR. So from everything I've heard, just hearing from Jake, which congratulations to him. He shot a really nice brown bear up there in Alaska, as well as a few black bears. So he's probably en route on his way back from Alaska, you know, right about now. Going to organize that for a 3D shoot, and then we've got just a small little local gathering of a dozen of us that are going to get together up at American Bowman's. It's a compound and trad team, so that ought to be interesting. Everyone throws $100 into the pot, and we'll see what happens, but it could get interesting. So in any case, I'm waiting on tags and notifications and stuff on some landowner vouchers. So far, I lost one hunt. I talked about that already. The hunt I was going to hopefully was going to get a tag for up in Wyoming, cashing my elk points. That didn't come together. And then I haven't heard anything back on a possible elk voucher for Colorado yet. So I'm nervous on that one. And then I'm waiting on word on a possible tag for Nevada for deer. So a lot of stuff still up in the air this late in the game, and it's super nerve-wracking. But meanwhile, just putting the nose to the grinding wheel on bow orders and trying to get those cranked out as fast as I can so we can get guys their bows and they can start practicing. But other than that, man, just enjoying the beautiful weather, green grass, and snow's melting, the rivers are running high, so the mule deer should be moving up in the mountains. The elk are growing their antlers out here pretty good. Been seeing some decent bulls here around town, and I am getting geared up. Started making some freeze-dried food. Got the freeze dryer going, made a bunch of double batch of Stedman bars over the weekend, and got those all vacuum sealed. And so getting an early start on the food, and I'm hoping that, you know, I'll have that done by the end of June so that I'm not doing any scrambling on last minute freeze dryer runs. Cause as my freeze dryer is up in my archery room above my work area in the shop. And so that room gets pretty hot, and the freeze dryer doesn't run as efficiently in the heat. So getting it done earlier in the year now, and I think it'll work out a little better. But in any case, we're going to do another chapter on Mike Mittens, One with the Wilderness. This is chapter 6, Antler Mines. Much of the land that once gave its wealth in the form of surface mined coal and was discarded as junk property has reclaimed its worth and is now teeming with wildlife. As demands increase for recreational property and the solitude and peace it can provide, abandoned strip mines have been taken notice by sportsmen. Modern agricultural practices can at times leave little in the way of cover and security. These mined lands can fill that need and attract significant herds of white-tailed deer, which are a renewable resource, furnish true sustenance, and present unique and coveted antlers to those who pursue them. The environmental, economical, and politically controversial practice of surface mining of coal has left many thousands of acres in a state of limbo. Surface mining involves stripping and scraping away the layer of soil and rock that lay above the coal deposits. In the past, once the coal was removed from the site, usually by train, the spoils of overburden were frequently left ungraded with no attempt to restore the topsoil. These spoil banks somewhat resemble the rhythmic wave-like surfaces of a plowed field, with the soil of each plow furrow lying against the next. Only with strip mining, the difference between the peaks and valleys of each furrow will be 6 to 30 feet and sometimes more. This, in effect, will significantly increase the surface area. The Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 requires that mined land be restored to the condition of equal or greater supporting capability than it had prior to mining. Much of the land we view as useful today was mined prior to SMCRA, which is the Strip Mine Reclamations Act there. Lands that were seeded for pasture provided quick usability, but were generally short-lived compared to lands where reclamation with trees was initiated. Trees play a major role in building productive soils. Some species, even on compacted earth, are able to grow deep root systems that improve the soil drainage and aeration. Trees also produce a tremendous amount of soil enriching biomass in the form of leaves and branches, increasing soil microorganisms and invertebrates, including earthworms and ants, perpetuating the nutrient cycles. Selecting and planting forbs, shrubs, and tree species that work together is important for rapid utility of vacant land. Many tree species provide cover and food for wildlife at a much faster rate than others. Species like the black locust that release nitrogen from root nodules are especially important as companion species for more desirable hardwoods. Legumes are very useful forbs that also fix nitrogen in the soil due to a symbiotic relationship with rhizobium bacteria. This nitrogen becomes available to other plants and is vital to the establishment from poor soils. Legumes such as clover species and bird's foot trefoil are highly nutritious and become one of the primary lures to attract and hold wildlife. Shrubs such as autumn olive, Russian olive, and alders also fix nitrogen into root nodules using actinomycetes. These mature shrubs also enhance soil by supplying a cover protection from erosion due to wind and rain, converse moisture, and increase humus. Wildlife will return in great numbers to the food, shelter, and nesting sites these shrubs ensure. The association to nitrogen-fixing trees and shrubs enhance the growth of other hardwoods and coniferous trees. Natural succession of volunteer species include the fast-growing cottonwoods, black cherry, hackberry, maples, walnut, and bur oak favor the enriched soils. Direct planting of preferred seedlings to increase diversity of reforestation can be achieved on graded or ungraded lands with the use of mattock or dibble. I have planted thousands of seedlings using a dibble, and it is my personal preference for use in stony and compacted soil. Dibbles come in various sizes and can be easily fabricated in a welding shop. The blade is a flat piece of steel that can be 4 to 6 inches wide and 5 to 7 inches long. A sturdy 3 or 4 foot long T-handle is welded to one side. The bottom of the blade is ground and honed to a sharp edge. I plant seedlings one at a time by using my foot to insert the blade of the dibble into the ground at a 45-degree angle away from me, and then pushing the handle forward to an upright position. Removing the dibble, I place the seedling to the correct depth in the newly formed V-shaped hole. I then insert the dibble 2 inches forward of the hole and move the handle toward the seedling. This action will close the hole and press roots against soil against the roots. I then simply firm the soil around the seedling with my foot. If planting is conducted in areas where deer and rodents such as rabbits have repopulated, then additional provisions to deter them from browsing must be considered. I feel it is mandatory to protect fruit trees. I plant Dolgo crabapple trees, which are blight resistant and produce a lot of fruit mass, but I did not leave them until they were each encircled with old stock fencing that had acquired from cleaning up neighboring farms. Larger areas of Douglas fir were enclosed as well. I have hunted thousands of acres of pre-SMCRA ungraded strip mines in the Midwest that have gone under 40 to 50 years of reforestation. The primary trees on much of the land are maturing black locust. These trees were the result of aerial seeding, which was conducted shortly after the completion of mining activities. Black locust trees tend to have a short lifespan, 15 to 30 years, and often succumb to locust borers. These die-offs create space for companion trees, and the dead trunks provide cracks and cavities that are used as nesting sites for small birds. They also harbor a variety of insects that attract many types of woodpeckers and similar birds. Black locust sea pods are food for quail and deer. Vast thickets of autumn olive, honeysuckle, and multifloral rose may be considered a nuisance, but it's hard to beat the security they afford to deer. The vegetative regrowth and the protection from adverse weather that the rough surface of soil banks present is usually in close proximity to water held in various resultant from the mining operation. This combination defines a sanctuary that deer can't resist. In the remainder of this chapter, I would like to share a few of my hunting experiences on such properties. Like most other terrain, the edge between different types of vegetation created by regrowth, such as dense autumn olive thickets adjacent to walnut or cottonwood trees, is associated with increased travel for deer. The bucks cruise this edge and more efficiently encounter does. We have to hunt them more efficiently as well. This is especially true during post-rut periods. I placed a stand in a hackberry tree in just such an edge during a late December hunt. I knew that the bucks tend to stage up in this area prior to moving out to feed in the stubble cornfield, and that the rut's peak had long since passed. Just before the edge of legal shooting time, I saw a group of 6 does and fawns move quickly through the area, nibbling on raspberry bushes as they went out in the open cornfield. A few minutes later, I heard the characteristic sounds of antlers against brush. The mature 5x5 was standing in a scrape with his neck fully extended above him, raking the overhanging limb. Knowing that he would most likely continue on and join up with the does, I decided to wheeze at him in hopes to bring him closer. I watched as he heard me. He lowered his head and ran straight toward me on a dead run. It kind of caught me by surprise because I have never seen this tactic work so effectively. I had little time to enjoy the encounter or even prepare for the shot. He charged right in and turned quartering at 5 yards. My arrow zipped through his chest and the buck bolted 10 yards and dropped. The whole thing happened so fast that there was no anticipation, anxiety, or even search. Since the buck was clearly dead and lying just there, I sat back in the seat and let my heart rate diminish a little before climbing down. Other edge situations are created on mined properties that may not be characterized by changes in the vegetation, but changes in the spoil banks themselves. I may find areas where the direction of the spoils are running changes. There may be areas where many spoils merge into one. I try to find an edge created where there is a sudden change in the height or simply changes in the steepness of the slope. There are sometimes many lakes or ponds created as a result of mining. I look for pinch points at the end of the lakes or between the lakes. all of these locations warrant closer attention, and I may find abrupt changes in the way the deer travel. Bottlenecks have been created that may not readily be apparent if searching out different vegetation is my only focus. I found a stand site where many low spoils dumped into one high spoil. This created a right angle change in the deer travel route, and at the point made them vulnerable to prevailing winds. I entered this stand at noon during an early November sitting. At 3:30 p.m., I heard a giant buck grunt and witnessed a doe seemingly appear from out of the ground as if it crested a low spoil. Two bucks followed her. As they approached, the larger buck assumed the classic role of lead pursuant behind the doe. The doe crossed below, stopped, and looked up at me, only to continue on. I hardly noticed her because my eyes were fixed on the deliberate arrival of the huge 5x5. I could see that he had several additional sticker tines and his antler bases were very heavy. He stopped at the same point as did the doe and looked up at me as well. I could not draw, but I felt that even if he didn't notice me, he would likely continue in the direction of the doe. He slowly turned his head and eyes forward and began to take his last few steps. As he moved to my right, I had to twist my body at my hips without shuffling my feet. Being a right-handed shooter, the offhand draw to my extreme right was uncomfortable, but I managed to focus on the buck's chest instead of my form. My hand locked to a solid anchor, which initiated the arrow's release. At the end of the brief blood trail, I found the buck. I recognized him as the same buck I had encountered the previous day in a stand 800 yards from this place. Only then did I take the time to recall the face of the doe and the bright white hair around her eyes. These were the same eyes that located me in the tree and alerted the same buck to my hiding place. I smiled as I knew I had cursed her survival instincts the previous day, and I must now thank her for leading this great buck I was now admiring. Let me give you another example of how differences in terrain improved my chances. I found another area where the drastic changes in terrain could be used to my advantage. Two high spoils dropped to a large, flat open. Two high spoils dropped to a large flat open area, allowing a thick patch of bird's foot trefoil to flourish in a very recognizable bottleneck. I placed a stand in a tree nearby and kept an eye on this area throughout the season. Every time I hunted this honey hole, I saw many deer. However, there is such a thing as having a spot that is too good. By that I mean there were always so many deer hanging around that eventually one of them would work their way downwind and bust me. Boy, I hate that. Eventually, I checked the area late in December and found that the trefoil had died down and deer seemed to be passing through in one direction, spending little time milling around. When the wind blew out of the south, which was uncharacteristic for this time of year, I took my chance. The tree I chose and surrounding backdrop had long since lost their leaves. I pressed tightly against the trunk of the only available black locust tree. It seemed to provide me little concealment. I began to relax as the unsuspecting does funneled past. They must have forgot about the danger they fled from earlier in the year. Their only concern was to keep moving toward their evening supper. I watched several family units pass with their speed racer yearlings chasing each other up and down the spoil banks. The matriarch doe relaxed her guard as the youngsters finally settled down and found their place. Flights of geese passed overhead signaled the closing of another day. I was on high alert during the last half hour of hunting. This was New Year's Eve. Thoughts of all the fun I had during the season and the awaiting shed hunting season was interrupted by the milling of a solo buck. He was in no hurry, but headed in my direction. I readied my bow and pressed the finger tab to the string. He was now 30 yards away, and then 25, then 20, then 15. But another group of does started to come, and one of them came quickly down the high spoil bank. If she continued her present course, she would be directly downwind of me. Not good. She stopped and began to stomp her feet. Again, not good. Suddenly, two fox squirrels commenced a chase of their own. Through the treetops they came. I could hear them coming above the doe. I stared at the buck, who, by this time, found that my form in the tree warranted another look. His stiff-legged approach was less than desirable. Our eyes were fixed. The squirrels, on the other hand, had brought their game of tag to my tree. They spiraled the branches, nose to tail, sending loose bark fragments raining down. The upper limbs fussed to the trunk, bringing their descent past me. They circled the trunk, brushing my cheek, passing beneath the arm of my video camera tripod, and crossed beneath my hip in the seat of the tree stand. They revolved the lower trunk until reaching the ground, where a foot race across open ground took place. The noisy disturbance was over, but neither the set of eyes, the buck's or mine, were distracted. The confrontation was intense. My mind seemed to race faster than the squirrel's. What was he going to do? What was the doe going to do? I felt as if I was on the center of two crosshairs. Finally, he began to move and turn sideways. His legs were stiff and his feet struck the ground with a resounding thud. I knew he was ready to bolt. I could see that the corner of his eye was black. I could not move. He made another turn, not quite 90 degrees. He was leaving. With composure lost, the killer instinct took over my motor skills. I suppose my subconscious cued the "he's getting away" response. I only know that I reacted with simultaneous raised bow arm, rotating body, and drawing motion, which sent an arrow towards the fleeing buck. The thing called hunting evokes many feelings, different feelings and reactions. This out of control response left me with a feeling of wonderment and disbelief. I knew better. I knew to wait for the perfect shot and execute it with flawless precision, but this time it was different. I had to block all the reasons why and speculation out of my head because I felt the arrow had struck the buck forward of the shoulder. I did find the arrow. It had a slight smear of blood full length. The fletching was not soaked, only wiped with blood. Looking to the ground, the path that the buck took was clearly evident. The blood trail was not streamed, but made by many individual and overlapping droplets. I followed the trail to an area of short spoils covered with autumn olive and honeysuckle. The evidence suggested a heavy muscle wound without severing the carotid artery or jugular vein. Backing out, I waited for morning. With the help of my brother, we followed the trail up and down spoil banks under thick vegetative growth and located at least four places where the buck laid down. Each time the trail became more faint until the single drops were over 40 yards apart. Our circling loops were growing wider. We were almost 500 yards from the stand site. My attitude was changing from hopeful anticipation of finding the buck to one of almost relief in the fact that I thought that the foreshoulder or low neck wound had stopped bleeding and had started a process of healing. I was convincing myself that the volume of blood resulting from the sum of the droplets found was insufficiently lethal. Boy, was I wrong. My brother came running up and exclaimed the 16-pointer was found. Doubting his proclamation, I was confused by what I thought I had already knew. As it turned out, the buck lay dead 150 yards ahead of me. The arrow did strike the lower neck, cutting heavy muscle as well as the trachea. This prevented significant amounts of blood from reaching the ground because it collected in his lungs. Noting the blood in the buck's nostrils, I realized I misrepresented the fading blood trail. The recovery of this buck let me know I was not perfect. I made a mistake in taking the shot in the first place, as well as nearly giving up on finding it. Sometimes while hunting, we do everything right, but the results may be disappointing. Other times we get rewarded when we are not deserved. Whenever I look at the mount of this buck, I remember the great animal. However, it is also a reminder of my shortcomings and a motivation for respect. I think we all need to be stewards of the land and conserve our natural resources. This is not always easy and may not always be the case as I think about certain hunting opportunities I've been afforded. I realize that with time, reforested, surface-mined land can provide an island of wildlife diversity in a sea of agricultural monotony. and thus wraps it up. Check my the Stalker Stick Bows Facebook or Instagram page for some pictures that accompany this chapter, because there are some nice bucks that Mike took in this chapter. All right. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Look forward to the next one.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. I come down for-